Good afternoon, everyone. We are calling the Minnesota Senate Elections Committee to order, and I want to thank everyone who has come to participate. We have a full agenda today, but first what I'd like to do is I'd like to introduce a few new people that have come to the committee as either staff or otherwise. I want to introduce my new committee legislative assistant, Christy Blood, who is the one that will answer the phone if you call me. And then I'd like to also say that we have pages, and maybe you could step up here so that people can see you and raise your hand when I mention your name. John Bridges, Luke Seck, and Spencer Olson. Thank you for your help. And then we have a new researcher, Tom Cheetah. Where is Tom? Okay, Tom is back there. So thank you, and we'll start out really quickly here. This is our first meeting of the year, and we do want to recognize that this is our first snow day of the winter of 2023-2024, and I'm hoping that this is also the last one, too. So it's Thursday, February 15th, 2024, and I've called this meeting to order, and a quorum is present. I want to welcome everyone back that's on the committee, and also welcome them to the 2024 legislative session. We did accomplish a lot last year, and I'm looking forward to another productive year, and we'll consider additional ways to protect and expand the freedom to vote and the protection of the people that work on our voting systems. We have four bills to hear today, and we have relatively few hearings because we have that short session this year, and it appears like we only have, I believe it's 12 more meetings, so we need to be very efficient. And if we are not efficient, we do have that day reserved on, that's on Tuesdays, that we'll have to go to the evening if we don't finish during the day. So I just want everyone to know that there's a possibility that we could go late, depending on speed that we get through these bills. We have this room reserved, so you would come back here on Tuesday evening if we do call it an evening session. If bills go late, then we'll just add them to the end of the following Tuesday's agenda. So let's get started. We have Senate File 3550, Senator May Quaid. And this is strengthening the deep fake prohibitions. Senator May Quaid, please proceed with your presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for agreeing to hear Senate File 3550, which updates the bill that prohibits the dissemination of deepfakes to influence an election. As a reminder, the law now states that it is a crime to disseminate a deepfake, which is defined as a video recording, motion picture film, sound recording, electronic image or photograph, or any technological representation of speech or conduct that is so realistic that a reasonable person would believe it depicts speech or conduct of an individual who did not, in fact, engage in that speech or conduct, and the production of which was substantially dependent upon technical means rather than the ability of another individual to physically or verbally impersonate such an individual. Senate File 3550 before you does four things. It adds to the definition of deepfake, that it is so realistic that a person would have a fundamentally and materially different understanding of the substance or meaning of the content of the speech or conduct compared to an unaltered original version. It clarifies that websites, social media, news media, and streaming services are not in violation of the law for distributing political advertisements that are or include the use of deepfake technology. It adds specificity to the language about the timeline of the use of deepfakes to influence an election, Currently, the law prohibits dissemination of deepfakes within 90 days of an election. The language before this committee updates that timeline to say within 30 days before a nominating convention, presidential primary, local primary, or special election, and then 90 days before a general election. So just to encompass all the kinds of elections that we might have. And then last, Senate File 3550 adds the conviction of disseminating a deepfake to the list of violations that could disqualify a candidate from holding various positions or allows a court to declare a candidate has forfeited a nomination. These are all contained already within the Fair Campaign Practices Act. So other convictions that could result in the forfeiture of a nomination or office include false claims of support for a candidate or ballot question, knowingly spreading false campaign material, or violations of disclaimer requirements for campaign materials. The provisions in this bill are important updates and fine-tuning to make sure we maintain the integrity of our elections, as well as protect speech as required by the First Amendment. When we passed our deepfake law last year, this bill received 200 out of 201 possible votes in the legislature, making it one of the most bipartisan bills of consequence that we passed all year. And I'm very proud of that. And I hope to keep that spirit of bipartisanship as we continue the important work to ensure we maintain integrity in our elections. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Makewade. You have a testifier, Mr. David Fisher from Clean Elections, Minnesota. Mr. Fisher, please be sure to sign in on the list there and also state your name for the record and begin with your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Great, for bringing this bill before the committee. Members of the committee, my name is David Fisher. I teach at the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm a former commissioner, Minnesota Commissioner of Administration, and member of the Metropolitan Council. Former, not now, don't blame me. I'm a strategic advisor and represent Clean Elections Minnesota, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working for an inclusive and healthy democracy in Minnesota. And in fact, just this last fall, we hosted a forum on artificial intelligence and election disinformation with the Brookings Institution. Excuse me. We believe that faith in elections and acceptance of results are among the most essential ingredients of a functional democracy. Yet even now, deep fake AI is turning the 2024 US presidential election into an unprecedented test in how to police deceptive content that are designed to fool people. An early salvo came this last month, as we all know, in New Hampshire, days before that state's presidential primary. An estimated 5,000 to 25,000 robocalls went out using a fake but convincing depiction of President Biden's voice to tell recipients not to bother voting. NPR reports that while fake robocalls are not new, making a persuasive hoax has gotten easier, faster, and cheaper thanks to generative AI tools that can create realistic images, video, and audio depicting things that never happened. These are things you know from passing last year's bill. But these attempts are growing and growing in complexity, and they're clearly attempts to interfere with the independent, nonpartisan electoral process, and is voter suppression pure and simple. The World Economic Forum recently issued a report in collaboration with Zurich Insurance Group. They surveyed over 1,400 global risk experts, policymakers, and industry leaders in September 2023, just this last September, about their biggest global concerns: AI-derived misinformation and disinformation, and its implication for global polarization, ranked ahead of climate change, war, and economic weakness as its top 10 risks over the next 2 years. And this fraud is particularly pernicious in the immediate run-up to an election, when there's little time for journalists, campaigns, or authorities to fact-check or debunk it. SF3550 addresses this issue head-on. At the same time, cautious approaches to mitigate the consequences of fraud reflect the need to weigh these potential harms against free speech rights. There's no truth in advertising rule in political advertising, but we can have solutions tailored to the problems identified in SF3550. We're trying to get this right. With paralysis now in the Congress, states like Minnesota are left to put up as many guardrails as we can to mitigate this risk. This year's provisions strengthen the deepfake bill, and Clean Elections Minnesota urges you to pass SF3550. Thank you for your important bipartisan work on this issue and your commitment to further strengthen our democracy.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Any questions from the committee to Mr. Fisher? Senator Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Senator Makewade, for bringing this forward. We all did work diligently last year on this. The expansion of it, and by the way, right, it was bipartisan, but I don't see any bipartisan authors on this bill brought before us today, so it's kind of curious to why. Senator Lucero or somebody wasn't consulted.
Senator Makewade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cran, I actually have two versions of this bill. I wasn't sure which one I was going to pursue. One that doesn't add in the dissemination of a deepfake into the violation of Campaign Fair Practices Act, and one that does. I believe that the one that doesn't add it in is the one that I circulated to my Republican colleagues, so my apologies for that.
Senator Grant, follow-up.
Thank you, Senator Makewade. Yeah, and so I'm a little bit concerned. I think we all share with us a new world, and changing the timelines again without – we haven't had an election cycle yet since we passed the last law. And I'm a little bit worried that we're one, making some new requirements, changing the timeline. And I think when you just described – when the testifier described it, it is true when it gets close to election, right, in the ability to counter or, you know, any of these actions, regardless of how it comes out, regardless of what technology is used to create that. With changing the date, I guess we probably should look at it and say, why would there be a time frame at all? Because basically you're saying a fraudulent activity is okay up until X. When, if it's truly fraudulent, regardless of technology, it should not be allowed ever. One, we've deemed it criminal. And so I'm kind of worried that we're delving into these changes before we even know and have any examples that we can, that have occurred in Minnesota. So with that, I think that'd be something from a future consideration. My greater concern is, how can we get by, you know, we've criminalized a particular technology from a fraud or what we've deemed fraud perspective to influence elections. There are 100 different ways to influence elections that we could deem illegal. In this case, using a specific defined technology, we've added now the removal of somebody from a ballot or removal of office. What other criminal activity? What other crime removes somebody from office?
Senator Makewade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Cran, to your first point about the timeline, I think the concern was that when we originally or currently in the law, it just says that takes place within 90 days before an election. And I think the question was, well, what is considered an election? Is it just a general election? Is it a primary election? Is it both? So we wanted to be really specific on what those were, and that's why you got all those enumerations there. With regards to the time frame, so limits to constitutional rights, when a court applies the strict scrutiny test to limits on constitutional rights, they ask, is it narrowly tailored for a compelling state interest with no less restrictive law possible? And so I look at a timeline as being narrowly tailored, right? We're saying it's really specific to the time in and around an election instead of just always. I mean, we are, you know, when we run for office, we are candidates, but once we're elected, we're also elected officials, and people like to make parodies and jokes and things about elected officials, as is their right to do under the First Amendment. And so we wanted to make sure that to not infringe on free speech rights, we're making it really specific and narrowly tailored to influencing an election around that time. But I do understand what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you. I fundamentally do not think that this technology is good to be used to depict anybody doing anything that they didn't do, really, truly. But that's why that timeline. To answer your other question about what other things, and it doesn't automatically disqualify someone from holding office or nomination. It is something that a court can determine. So other things that violate the Fair Campaign Act: false claims of support for candidates or ballot questions, the use of the term reelect following redistricting unless the candidate is an incumbent of the office which represents part of the new district, violations of disclaimer requirements for campaign materials, improper use of non-commercial signs, violations of requirements for paid advertisements, including disclaimers and rates, knowingly spreading false campaign material, exerting undue influence on voters, election intimidation, interference, or other deceptive election practices. This is where I felt adding in this specificity, it was natural, because we've already outlined that, but at the time that this statute was made, AI and deepfakes weren't a thing. Improper use of influence to compel an individual to join a political organization or to partake in political activities, attempting to bribe another individual to cease being a candidate or to refrain from running for office, election day violations, including soliciting near polling places, illegal expenditure of campaign funds, bribery or bribery to sway a voter, bribery of officials or bribery to sway a voter. And then there is a note in this section that forfeiture of office does not apply to these violations if a court determines that a violation was trivial, if a violation happened as a result of a good faith accident, or if a court determines that forfeiture would be unjust. So there is a really robust Fair Campaign Act, and then underneath all of those things that lays out what violations are, that's where the piece of forfeiture of nomination or the office already exists. So we're just adding this to a very lengthy list.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Senator McQuaid. But you just described a whole host of the campaign violations, right? We've the campaign finance, and we've a whole host of those, right? Truth and advertising, all of those things apply. But we've never had anything that says, well, removal of office. We already have cause or action to be able to do that within the body and within the voters. And so to take the action that you are adding removal of office as a condition of a campaign violation, what was technically a campaign violation all in the past, but now we're utilizing a new technology. And technologies are going to rapidly change, and you and I know that. And so that's my greatest concern. We don't have, we don't have any examples of it that we have to deal with, but or as of yet. But removal of office, we already have those things in place today. And the adjudication process is going to take weeks, months, years. You've made it criminal, and so to be able to validate that, and what technologies are available to validate that? That's what I worry about. I think you and I both as candidates, how to validate and protect ourselves from someone else in acting on our behalf. And so what does that mean, and how do we get that? How do we defend ourselves from that? And I'm a little bit worried about removing people from ballots outside of the voters and things that were campaign finance violations. None of them were ever would lead to that, because we already have cure or cause to do that or to take care of it within this body. So to leave it in a criminal justice system, because I believe in this body, we've now made it legal for a felon who is not currently incarcerated but still on paper can now run for office. So I'm a little confused at how we would remove somebody that's maybe prosecuted or that you would have to be prosecuted, but you could be a felon on paper and still be in elected office or run for office. So I'm a little conflicted on that message from what was passed last year in candidate eligibility.
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Crenn, I think the important distinction is that this requires a conviction. So the standard would be in a court of law, it would be a conviction for violating this statute and then entering a supplemental judgment declaring that the candidate has forfeited the nomination or office in accordance with the statute that already exists. I think the difference between, it's a felony to steal a $500 iPhone, right? But stealing a $500 iPhone, going to jail for it, coming out, maybe deciding to run for office is really different than using generative AI or deepfake technology to influence an election and then be in office having done that, right? And so I think that's where the difference is that it's not just saying like, oh, you committed a crime. It's specifically related to the election and related to the office that you were running for. And so the threshold for conviction and nomination forfeiture or removal from office is quite high because it requires a conviction in a court of law. And it can't be for trivial things, right? So the part of the statute that it can't be trivial, or if it was a good faith accident, or if the forfeiture would be unjust. So the threshold is quite high statutorily to be removed from office or forfeit your nomination already. This just adds the, that this very serious crime that we deemed as a body that it was a crime of disseminating a deep fake to influence an election, being convicted of that crime, and then a court could enter that judgment.
Senator Grant. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Quaid. I just think that the standard is moving too far too fast to be able to impose a court. Again, you talk about, because this is a much higher crime, all of them are crimes, and everything can be used to influence an election. And just because of a specific technology now for removal of office just doesn't seem like, or it seems like we'll be creating a process where we're chasing our tail on technology and advancements of technologies to always address it when we haven't for other serious crimes that would involve elections, and I get it, right, for the office. There's so many things that can occur that didn't and won't lead to removal of office, except for the use of this specific technology to commit a crime or fraud against anybody or against the people to influence an election. So I have real concerns about that. We're moving a little too fast before we get the first bill enacted, so. Mr. Chair, I don't have any other questions at the moment.
Senator Makewade, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Crenn, I think I'd be really interested to hear what other crimes one could commit related to an election that wouldn't be contained herein, forfeiture of the nomination or removal from office. But I think the biggest concern that I have is that the law we passed is good, and like all laws, requires fine-tuning. And we're about to head into an election year, and so I think my goal always with this bill was to get ahead of a problem. I don't want to be sitting before this committee with an example, because laws after the fact tend to look like they're responding to the thing instead of being a statement of where we would like things to be or stay. And so my hope is that we can pass this into law so that we don't have examples sitting in front of this committee, so that there isn't a member of this body or a member of Congress or, you know, whoever that is out there where we have to then look at this law through that lens. I think it's better to do it ahead of time so we can keep that from happening.
Senator Wesson, deferring. Any other questions? Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read through this bill again earlier, and I had some of the same questions Senator Coran mentioned. I had my staff go. I said, go get the bill we had last year, because I wanted to remind myself what we did and how it went through. And yeah, it passed. We had several hearings, several reiterations on it. There was good bipartisan work. You worked closely with Senator Lucero on it. And it resulted in a 66-1 final vote in the Senate and 131-0 final vote in the House. As I'm reading through the new insertions in this language, I do not see it coming across with the same bipartisan intent that I feel it veering a lot closer to First Amendment issues than what we had before. I also had the same question. We haven't even had an election to test how the law that we applied last year went. And I think we really should see, did we do a fair enough job? Did we have issues with it? Was there something that still fell in the cracks? Give us something that we can measure it on. I had pretty strong reservations about the paragraph that's on page 2 of the new language there, lines 25 to 27. We're adding, having a fundamentally or materially different understanding of the substance or meaning of the content of the speech or conduct compared to the unaltered original version. I read that as very subjective According to who? According to a prosecutor who wants to challenge, and if the prosecutor is of a different bent than the person they're going after. If there's a satirical recording of a candidate, if it's going after my candidate, I'll go, well, that's not a fair representation. And you would probably say, oh, it sure seems fair to me. Or if the roles were reversed, I'd go, yeah, that one looks fair. And you would go, well, that doesn't look like a fair representation to me. As we go through the fair campaign practices that we reiterated, we have objective, measurable standards that we can use, especially if we're going to add disqualifying someone from the ballot, which I want to speak on more later. But what's already in the Fair Campaign Practices Act are things that you can measure, test, that are black and white, either they happened or they didn't. Using a false claim of support, that's easy to test. You claim someone's supporting you, you can find out either they are supporting you or they aren't. It's measurable, it's objective, we can figure it out. Commercial, you know, whether the signs have the proper exemptions and whether the campaign materials have the proper notices or ads or disclaimers that are on them. I'm going down the list of the sections here in 211B, and I can't find one that I think strikes me as would be open to interpretation, whether someone thinks maybe it would be viewed based on who's trying to charge it or prosecute it or go after it. It seems pretty cut and clear. Either this happened or it didn't, and that can be measurable, you know, around a solicitation around a polling place within, is it 300 feet? Like, we can have a tape measure and we can measure the distance and figure out objectively you're either inside the prohibited circle or you're outside of it. But I read this and I don't see that same objective standard. I think it's subjectively according to I don't know who believes that something that's out there is fundamentally and materially different understanding compared to the original speech or content, which I also don't know if a lot of deep fake things being put out there are not being written against an original video. That's why it's a deep fake to begin with, because it's trying to say something that was not an originally made video. And I just read that and think that could be up to a prosecutor who would like to find a candidate to get off the ballot. I don't know. I don't read that with the same objective standard that the rest of 211B has. I also have concerns about that we're adding in specifically calling out the private parties, political parties' own nominating conventions. We have those are 100 people, you know, a few hundred people locally in your district. You probably know many of them. The candidates are reaching out to them. The candidates should be able to get within themselves if someone's trying to use that drastic of a tactic to defeat another candidate. The opposing candidate has the easy recourse to put the truthful information out that rebuts that without the need of raising this to the level of a criminal statute that goes before a judge. So I've got pretty significant questions with most of the new language that got issued in here. Especially, I don't recall if the bill last year had a severability clause at the end of it. Maybe it did and I missed it. This one does, and it made me wonder why. Like, I read through the bill going, this feels a lot closer to First Amendment violations than what we had last year. And I don't know if the severability clause is in there because deep down we might assume, hey, this might happen and we're trying to protect ourselves here. I would prefer that we leave the good bipartisan law that we passed last year as it is, let it get tested. Let's not be adding things. We have a new section in here about, and I'll mention this in as a final point. You talked about it still has to go before a judge to determine if they're going to be removed from the ballot or not. But your language on page 4 says a court must enter supplemental judgment declaring a candidate if we have a violation of this section. So we don't have wiggle room in here. And throwing candidates off ballots is now a very hot political topic because of the ways it's being used around the country, and not just nationally. It's popping up in other states, in particular state races. So I don't think this is a good time to be inserting that type of language and recourse here. I think we did a good job with what we addressed last year. It hasn't even had time to be tested and implemented, and I would prefer us to let that bipartisan work continue to stand, see how it plays out in an election cycle, and see if it needs to be addressed again afterwards. Thank you.
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator McQuaid, for bringing this bill. I agree with you. I think now is the time to be having this discussion. I think I applaud you for doing this work before we have an issue here in Minnesota, and we certainly know, as you mentioned, there have been issues in other states, so it seems that it probably is a matter of time before it comes beyond our borders. But so appreciate the work that you are doing. I also would just mention that, you know, we know that AI technology is moving and expanding quickly and changing, and so there are things probably applicability that are in place and potential now that maybe even weren't when we initially debated this bill. And so it is our job to sort of try to keep up with things and come back and make changes as needed. So thank you for that work. My question maybe is more for the chair of the path and the plan for this bill. Are we where are we sending this bill, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bolden, it will be referred to Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect that might be the case, as some of the discussion and conversation here seems to be maybe more within that Judiciary space, which seems like an opportunity to continue to have some of those bipartisan conversations and work, and certainly that work will continue in Judiciary. So thank you for that.
Senator McQuaid, any comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate the discussion. There's two parts that I would like to, there's a few things I should say. Senator Matthews, I hear what you're saying. I think it's really important to look at the Fair Campaign Act. There are lots of things under that that are what you might consider subjective, not measuring it within 300 feet, but the improper influence to compel an individual to join a political organization could be quite subjective. Influence in and of itself can be subjective. The intimidation or interference, that can also, somebody standing with a gun near a polling place to protect it or to intimidate voters, that could be subjective in a court of law. So there are a lot of things under here that are subjective. I think what's important about this piece of legislation is, one, it's adding specificity to what we already did. So it's not dramatically changing what we passed before, but I do think it's important for us to be specific. The reason we added a severability clause, for example, is because it's not been in the courts. The courts are going to have these lawsuits about legislation related to AI come before it, as it should, and there will be tests and there will be boundaries drawn, as courts do, and I think that's important. I think it's also important that pieces of this legislation stand, even if other parts of it are interpreted differently or are weakened, strengthened, whatever. And so I think that's why it's really important to have that, because this is a new frontier for all of us. We are really grappling with technology that you're looking and seeing and hearing something that did not happen from somebody who did not do it. There has never been a time in our life where we could look at something and be so sure we are looking at the real thing, and it absolutely is not. It tests our sense of reality in a way that's really troubling. The other part I would like to bring up is that I think without being really clear what an election is, we could be running into many more court cases where people are saying, well, this happened 90 days before my primary, but we didn't say if it was a primary election or a general election or a special election, which we've had in our state and might have coming up soon. The last part is that I think it's really, really important for us to put in, and this starts on line 3.15 and goes down to 3.19, that news media, websites, social media, newspapers, you know, electronic publications, they're not in violation of this law for putting out political ads that someone might purchase and put out on their airways. And I really think that's very important that we pass and put into law, especially as we head into an election cycle. I would really like it to be clear that we are not holding, you know, our news media accountable for the deep fakes that other people might create and then sell as political ads. And then finally, I just think it's really important to talk about the fundamentally and materially different understanding of the substance or meaning of the content or the speech or conduct. This was a really good example. I was on a panel with an FEC commissioner and an expert in AI, and we were talking about the use of AI to influence elections. He said he really liked Minnesota's bill. He thought it was really good, but that it could use some specificity. But the example he gave was there's a person who's running in North Carolina, I believe, for Congress, and they filled out a written questionnaire. And in the written questionnaire, they answered a question, and then somebody made a deepfake of that person answering it audibly. And he said, no, I think that's a fair use of it, because the person did write that down. And I said, well, sure, but what you're losing between writing and talking is tone and inflection. And so I could answer a questionnaire, and I could say, absolutely, I'm for that. And then somebody could make an AI deepfake of me that's saying, like, yeah, absolutely, I'm for that. Those are two totally different meanings, even though the words are exactly the same. Senator Matthews, I think you know this. I think you're an attorney. Fundamentally and materially different are like legal thresholds that someone would have to meet. So if somebody created a video of me and they spliced together a bunch of different speeches I gave to ultimately show me saying, I think we should ban all dogs from the state of Minnesota, well, that would be fundamentally and materially different than whatever all the speeches, one where I said I and one where I said love and then one where I said dogs, and you know, they came up with something different. So I think this is just adding specificity to a law that we passed that had great bipartisan work to make sure that before we head into an election cycle, we have the strongest and most robust law. And I think I already said finally at least twice, but this is the last and final thing. We do have a list of Fair Campaign Act violations that do cause somebody to lose a nomination or forfeit office. It is a really high threshold to meet. And I think we've already said that this influencing an election in this way, and this would have to be the candidate, right? They would have to participate in this, participate in the dissemination. It's not just someone who does it on behalf of them. It's not just someone who does it for them or so that they win or that the other person loses, but it would have to be you actually involved in a very deep way of committing a crime to influence an election. I believe that like the other things, like bribing somebody or using undue influence to compel someone to join a political organization or not run for office, if you try to influence an election with criminal behavior, I do not believe you should be able to stay in office or be on the ballot. And so we've said that before in our law already. We have set those standards. I think this is one we should add. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate everything Senator Bolden said about I'm so proud that Minnesota is ahead of the curve on this. I think historically, whether it's with social media or different things, a lot of legislatures have been behind the curve, and we've seen our children get hurt because of it. I, coming from a broadcast background, you know, there have been cases where, especially to women, people do all sorts of crazy things. So if we can stay ahead of it, I wouldn't be surprised if we have to fix a lot even more in a couple years, because new things will be coming out even before any of us sit for election before. So I think staying ahead of it is really an amazing thing to be doing. And with that said, I would like to move the bill, make a motion to move the bill to Judiciary.
Senator Mitchell moves the bill. Senator Matthew, discussing.
Mr. Chair, if we're rushing to a vote, I've got at least one more question then that has come back up with this. So I don't know how you want to handle the motion on here, but would you allow me then one more shot at discussing
this? Senator Matthews.
Senator McQuaid, thank you. So we went, I appreciate your answers on here. You're correct in fundamental and materially different have specific meanings. I'm gonna throw this question at you. It still comes down to according to who. Who's the umpire that is setting the strike zone? Because I'm gonna go back what I said before in 211B, has tangible things that we can measure. Either you did or you didn't. And I pulled up even the one that you replied with, intimidation. I pulled that up to read it in detail, and it gives pretty clear definitions. Directly or indirectly use or threatening force, coercion, violence, restraint, damage, harm, loss of employment, or economic reprisal. Those things are pretty clear of either they were done or they were not done. And I'm still hung up on, we're adding something that feels very, very subjective in. And this is not just something to throw off to the Judiciary Committee, because where is the Elections Committee saying we've decided this topic should be something that qualifies for criminal prosecution? They will deal with the criminal prosecution side. We're the one to deal with, why are we picking this an election policy that qualifies for that level of criminal recourse? So let me throw that out to you. The page two changes that you have, you believe it's fundamentally and material different according to who?
Senator McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Matthews, if you look at line 2.22, we have defined it that it is so realistic that a reasonable person would. So the legal threshold, much like in other places of law, reasonable person is the who.
Senator Matthews, follow up.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did read over that, and I assumed that that was going to be what was going to be the response. I think this definitely needs to be worked over. I'm not comfortable with the language as it is put out. I think maybe you can get at it, and I'd encourage you. You need some bipartisan work on this, and. You admitted you had two versions of the bill, and we're hearing the version of the bill that you didn't send out for some bipartisan feedback on it. So I'm not ready to vote for this bill right now. I would encourage us to consider tabling it or bringing the other version here to the committee that did get floated around to bipartisan senators. Otherwise, I'm not in a position to support this today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. Senator McQuaid.
Mr. Chair, and just to be very clear, it was a mistake on my part. I had two versions of this bill, and I mistakenly circulated the jackets. There wasn't an intent to distribute different jackets. I just distributed different jackets. Mr. Chair, if I'm going to continue, I think it's really important, Senator Matthews. So. Yes, reasonable person is the who, but fundamentally and materially, like we talked about, do have legal meanings. They have specific meanings in a court of law, but even their plain meanings, right? Like a fundamentally different meaning. So it's not saying that it was confusing or that it was vague, but it would be like saying you gave a speech where you said, I want every room to be painted blue, and somebody changed it so you said, I want every room to be painted red, right? That is a fundamentally different understanding, or I would never paint a room. I'm trying to give really innocuous examples so that nobody ever quotes me as saying something really off the wall. But if they said, you know, I support seceding to South Dakota, right, instead of I do not support seceding to South Dakota. Those are the fundamental differences, right? When it's kind of the opposite of what you have said. If you have suggestions for how you would like this to be clarified, I would be very much open to hearing that, and I think this is what the committee work is for. But I think that it's important that we are specific in this time before we hit the election this year about what we do and don't want conduct to be in our elections, particularly when it comes to new and evolving technology that has never been as accessible to all kinds of individuals as it is now.
Thank you. We have a motion on the floor. Everyone in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator McQuaid, your bill is forwarded to the Judiciary Committee. But I would ask that you
take some time to look at the differences between the two bills that you have and see if there you can find some way to make some partisan progress with it. Our second bill is Senate File 3481, authored by Senator Westland. This is expanding doxing protections for election officials and law enforcement. And Senator Westland, I see you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment to get the bill into the form which you want it considered?
I would like to move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland moves the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Westland, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to be back together, and I look forward to our work this coming session. As you may recall, last year we did provide some protections in a variety of bills. It was included in the election omnibus bill. And since last session, with the help of staff, we've been looking at what some other jurisdictions are doing. And what we are proposing to do here is add a couple of additional layers of protection in this section. You will look at line 1.16. We are including home telephone number, cell number, personal email, the name of the official's child, photographs of the official's child, home address, directions to a home, or photographs of a home. And what the amendment does, it adds the word minor child to make it clear that we're talking about minor children as opposed to adult children. And personal information, again, is being defined on 2.7 also to include those items and to, again, add, I believe we are adding there also minor child in following the word official. We are changing the dissemination of information to be defined as public availability of information. There were some challenges with the term dissemination, and we felt that that was a little bit more precise. So at this point, what we do know is that election officials, including those who volunteer to assist with the elections, are often finding themselves subject to harassment and so forth. We had this discussion last year, and we do want to make sure that we are adding just an additional layer of protection, particularly regarding minor children and information about the homes of election officials. I do have one testifier who would like to provide some additional background information again about the problems that we have with this type of personal information being out into the public arena. And I would just reiterate also that this doxing protection actually covers both law enforcement officers as well as election officials.
Thank you, Senator Westland. And I believe you have Mr. David Maeda, who is the Deputy Secretary of State and Director of Elections. So, Mr. Maeda, please identify yourself and your voice for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Maeda. I'm the Director of Elections for the Minnesota Office of the Secretary of State, and I want to thank Senator Westland for bringing this forward, and thank you for passing the law last year that you did. I think it's timely that this is being heard today. I've had an interesting couple of weeks. Last week, I was at the National Association of State Elections Directors Conference, and many of the panels had to deal with things, steps we can do as election officials to keep ourselves safe. Things like keeping Narcan in our mail rooms, because officials in Washington and Georgia and other states were mailed envelopes with fentanyl in it. And steps like contacting our local law enforcement, getting our home address inside the 911 system, so if we're a victim of swatting, the officers responding have additional information that they can respond to. I know that isn't addressed in this bill, but I think it's indicative of the environment that we've been operating in the past few years as election officials. This past Tuesday, I was in Rice County and I attended their public accuracy test in Faribault. And the auditor there did a tremendous job in showing how our voting equipment is safe and secure in doing the public accuracy test. I will say there was a group of people there that were there for a different purpose and got very angry that she wasn't going to make this a public hearing, to the point where I had to be escorted to my car and was confronted by these people in the parking lot. And then this morning we saw on X that there's a picture of my professional headshot along with the article the Tribune did when I was appointed to this position in 2019 posted on X in a posting that had nothing to do with the information that was accompanying the post. Again, that's not covered in this bill, but I think we should note that one of the things that concerns me going into 2024 is the turnover we're seeing at the county level. We are seeing a lot of new county election officials. I remember a conversation I had with one of our county auditors in the southern part of the state in 2021, and he told me, this is getting too much. Elections is just, I don't want to do it anymore. And he told me that previously the ditch and drainage work he did was the least favorite part of his job, but now by far elections had become difficult to do. I'll point in this bill, I'm really glad to see that the name and photograph of of an official's child is included in the definition. I remember talking to a Metro County election official who told me, I can take the personal attacks on my integrity, but if they start going after my family, that's a bridge too far and I'll step down. So any protections that we can give to our election officials, I think, are very important. So I thank you again for bringing this bill forward. Yeah. Stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Maeda. Any questions from the committee? I have one, Mr. Maeda. Are we doing enough? Are we doing enough? Is there more we can do? My Dakota County auditor came to me very serious-faced a couple of weeks ago and said, Jim, you have to protect the election workers. They're generally of higher age, and they're getting frayed, and they won't volunteer. We're having trouble getting election judge volunteers. Now, making people feel safe is... that's an open question, but is there something that we should be continuing to do before we get to the election season so that what happened to you doesn't happen to them?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. People have the right, First Amendment rights to free speech, so they certainly, we welcome any questions about elections to try to answer their questions. I think the only thing I can really think of that you can do and members of the committee can do is if you hear questions from your constituents about the integrity of the elections, if you don't know the answer to it, or respond to it in a truthful way that gives people confidence in our election system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Maeda, and Senator Wesson, more. Thank you. So I just want to mention also that because we wanted to hear this bill fairly early on, I dropped it without, I think, any co-authors. And so I would welcome any of my colleagues on this committee, if you're interested in being a co-author on the bill. We have 4 slots open, so happy to have any co-authors.
Thank you, Senator Wesson. Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wilson, I will take you up on that offer to join as a co-author on this bill. Thank you for bringing it. And thank you, Mr. Maeda, for the work that you and your staff are doing. I just want to remind us all and the public who is listening of like really who we're talking about here. These are thousands of Minnesotans who are the people who make our elections run. These are our neighbors and our friends, and this is why our elections run so well here in Minnesota, because we have dedicated volunteers in many cases who are working really hard under increasingly difficult circumstances to do the really important work of making our democracy work and go. And so thank you to everyone who is doing that. And I think this is exactly what we should be doing to make sure that they are protected, because we need people to continue to do this work. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bolton. Mr. Maeda, are we getting enough education out there about elections? One of the things I'm thinking about is we needed to know more about elections. So our community administrator, Beth Fraser, arranged a visit to Scott County that's going to happen tomorrow. And what I'm thinking is that anybody that goes there, they should go there with questions, and they should come back with answers. And I think that's probably one of the steps we need, is more people need to know how the elections are run, what are the, and you know, have their questions in their mind when they call their auditor, call their election worker, and ask them about it, so that they can get confidence that that their questions are being heard and then also acted on if there needs to be some action. One of the things that I know I did in the last couple of years is when I would get somebody that was very upset about our elections, is my response was almost always, go to the election training, sign up to be an election official. And I'd have to say, I don't know that I've gotten any response from those folks where they continued with their mistrust to elections. And I did see some of them being signed up as election officials, and I assume they served. But I think when you learn about the elections controls and behaviors and the securities, your questions are answered. And I think if there's any way that we can make that more accessible to people, I would really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's a tremendously good idea. I've always encouraged elected officials to meet with your county auditors. If you have questions about elections, meet with your county auditors. I know when I, in my previous position as a city clerk in Minnetonka, we would always meet with our legislative contingent, including Senator Soczynski, we met with, to go over the things we do in elections to make sure that they are fair and accurate. So meeting with election officials, I think, is a great idea. For those that are skeptical about our elections, being an election judge is a great idea. You get to see all the protections that are in place. You get to go through the training that is provided. We always encourage people that have questions about elections to sign up to be poll workers.
Thank you, Mr. Maeda. Senator Cram.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Westland, for bringing it forward and the comments. We want everybody to be safe and secure, and hopefully this seems pretty small because almost all of this information is available publicly, right? So I think, Mr. Maeda, you've described real material things that probably would be great for everybody to understand, those types of things that you guys experience as county administrator or as a Secretary of State deputy, but county administrators. I think the last time we heard these bills, I think the underlying bill was about all of the harassment, and it was seemed to be at that point a lot of grievances based on the local government, and less about, right, those material things that actually happened to election judges around doxing and those types of things. So protection is great and important. The average person, all they want to know is transparency, right, so everybody can believe in it. But the entire legislative body in this process, which we're still waiting for you to define all of the rules to what you passed last year, leads us further away from transparency and that trust. So we agree it needs to be believable and trust and protect all of the people there. I hope that this does provide some protection, although it is pretty benign and all public information already. And so material things that provide you staff, Mr. Maeda and those guys, those things I think we should certainly look at and talk about, those things that are occurring that actually happened. And again, move towards transparency. And again, I hope this bill provides some protection and that people can feel safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Westland, any further comments?
No, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to make a motion?
I would like to move Senate File 3481 as amended, and I believe its next stop is to Judiciary and Public Safety.
Senator Westland moves Senate File 3481 be recommended to pass to the Judiciary Committee as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
That may
motion
never happen
has passed.
Again.
You're on your way. Okay, next is Senate File 3449, Senator Bolden. This is on consolidating political committee spending on local elections with the Campaign Finance Board. Senator Bolden, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It is good to be before you this afternoon. I have a bill that is fairly straightforward. It consolidates campaign finance reporting spending by PACs and political parties on local independent expenditures with the Campaign Finance Board. Currently, this is done in some jurisdictions in Hennepin County, but this would standardize the process and make that the case statewide. Currently, this happens locally through a local clerk or other office, and this would create a standard process so that all of that would happen through the campaign finance board, and we have been in conversation with them, and they feel this is something that they could take on. It also includes some pieces of clarifying language, which I can walk through. It clarifies the requirements for pre-primary reports in local races, which passed last session. The change is a change in name. It replaces references in statute to pre-primary reports with July reports to clarify that the requirements still apply for seasonal reporting even if a primary is not being held. Alongside other clarifications around timelines. Secondly, it provides some clear definitions, timelines, requirements around financial reporting, including clarifying the requirements only apply to candidates who have exceeded the threshold of the spending over $750. It removes some language from the definition of candidate, which is out of compliance with federal law. It updates some language related to contribution limits to better reflect contributions made by PACs, political funds, and parties. It also adds some cleanup language related to contributions made during the legislative session. It expands penalties for failure to keep accurate accounts to include candidates. It modifies the definition of committee to reflect changes in reporting structure, making other minor clarifying changes to Chapter 211A to reflect the language which has been moved to Chapter 10A. And lastly, it repeals some language which is now irrelevant in Chapter 211A. So again, essentially this is creating a standard process and a streamlined process. And of note, it will relieve some work and effort from localities and consolidate this work with the Campaign Finance Board, who is very comfortable and used to doing this work. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have one testifier.
Thank you, Senator Bolden. I believe you have a testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do.
Please introduce your testifier.
She is on Zoom, Mr. Chair.
She's on Zoom, okay. Senator Rest. Okay.
It's Karen McLaughlin, Mr. Chair.
Should we go to Senator Rest's question while we're while the technical issues are being taken care of? Senator Rest, your question.
Yes.
I see.
Closer to the mic, please, Senator.
I see Mr. Sigurdsson is here, but if the campaign finance board is going to oversee this, and the reports are going to be made to the campaign finance board, are they going to be using the? Are they going to be required, like all the rest of us, to use the campaign finance software unless it is impossible to do so? I don't see anything in the quickly in looking at the bill, and certainly not in the summary that you mentioned how the reporting is going to happen and what the responsibilities are for doing that. I wonder, either you comment or Mr. Sigurdsson.
Senator Bolden, appears you have a first responder coming.
Mr. Chair, I would welcome Mr. Sigurdsson's input on this question as well.
And Mr. Sigurdsson, please introduce yourself for the record and continue with your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the executive director of the Campaign Finance Board. Senator Rest, to your question, all committees are required under Chapter 10A to file electronically unless they're granted a waiver because of their size. So if there was an extremely small local committee, expenditures, contributions of less than $5,000, they can apply for a waiver, at which point they would then file a paper report, which is still posted on our website, but they wouldn't be required to use the online application.
So Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sigurdsson or Senator Bolden, so you don't need any language in here to make a specific requirement for this to happen because the general law already requires anyone that has to file with campaign finance board to follow the rules for any campaign. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, that is correct. The basically the local committees formed around ballot questions and local candidates are now going to be incorporated into the general provisions of Chapter 10A, so all provisions in Chapter 10A will now apply to them.
And so, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
So when a candidate has a committee and is filing it to start with, and then determining, they get information that will determine whether they need to file a report because under certain circumstances they will not have to. Is that correct?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
You just mentioned how much they have to file a campaign committee if they raise or spend $750 still, but at what point is a report at the end of a campaign cycle or whenever it's required, what triggers it? If they only raise and spend $750, they file a committee, what triggers them having to file a report?
Mr. Sigurdsson, we've got two thresholds quoted here, 500 and 750.
Mr. Chair, I'll maybe jump in here because I'm wrong, Senator Rest. I think what you're asking is about a candidate, and I just want to clarify that this bill is related to PACs, political parties, those who are spending money in local elections, ballot questions, those types of things. This isn't specific to candidates.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then I must have misread.
Senator Rest.
Misread the summary.
Senator Bolden, any further comment on this subject?
Mr.
Sigurdsson.
Senator Rest.
I see now. In Section 3.
It may just more generally, Chapter 10A, I think one of the issues with Chapter 211A is that there's never a close-off. You're never really required to file a last
sure.
report. Under Chapter 10A, you certainly do. Once, and you, either have to continue to file reports or you you close out. And so this is kind of providing a more of a structure how the reporting is done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
Senator Rest. Any other questions from the group? Yeah, let's, Senator Matthews. You want to defer?
Do you want to hear the testifiers?
Should we hear the testifier? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The testifier is ready now and hooked up, so we'll hear the testifier. Please identify.
Are you ready for me?
Identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Karen McLaughlin. I am a current member of the Rochester School Board. I'm in my, just starting my fourth year of my first term. I also have the experience of running for a different local office and also working on a campaign for a different local candidate. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 3499. I want to thank Senator Bolden for inviting me for this opportunity. I personally value our democracy. And part of what I value is that our democracy is stronger when the voices and interests of voters are at the center. As a local candidate, honoring this value and commitment to voter voices includes publicly disclosing the influence of non-voting entities, groups like parties and PACs are having on our local elections. Greater spending transparency is also helpful to local candidates of all political leanings. It helps to ensure that the candidates themselves, their values and their ideas are at the forefront of voters' minds, not just information or messaging shaped or advanced by non-candidate interest groups. Thank you for this opportunity, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Any questions for the testifier? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. McLaughlin, is there something wrong with the system that we have right now that needs to be fixed?
Ms. McLaughlin.
From the local perspective, I would look at it in terms of information, transparency, and even where to find the information about the local candidates. For example, as a school board member, our information is filed with the school district. The city offices like city council are filed with the city. The county information is filed with the county. Township candidates is filed with the township. And again, from the voter perspective, I think if people are looking for campaign finance information about all of those candidates, they have to look in all those different places for local candidates in addition to candidates at the state level for the campaign finance board and other offices. So I think consolidating that all in one place would be a move towards making the information more accessible to voters who are looking for this type of information about local candidates.
Senator Bolden, you have some
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, what I would add to that is I think, you know, our current system is disparate. So local candidates are reporting to localities through a clerk or another office locally, which is in some locations a burden on those staff who may be doing many other things in addition to having that be part of their role. So this would take that burden off of them and streamline the process. And it would provide standardization of resources, again, for local candidates, if they are reaching out, if they have questions, and they're reaching out to, say, a local clerk, who, you know, this may be one small piece of their larger role, they may not have the abundance of resources that the campaign finance board would be able to offer those candidates. And so, for those reasons, I think this is a win on both sides of that equation.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
Senator Bolden. I have not had any complaints about this system the way it is right now. I have not had a county official or a township officer or school boards people complaining about the way they have to deal with processing or filling out materials and things like that. I think we're looking for something that, to me, doesn't need to be fixed. I think it's good the way it is. It sounds good on what you're saying. Standardizing, putting all things together. But to me, it takes away local control. It means that you're putting the state in charge of this whole thing. And I just simply stay with the county and the township and the school boards. Thank you.
Senator Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Anderson, Senator Anderson, for the what the why. We heard this solution be easier, but it really local control was about it's their job. And so what wasn't described is what gets better or what violations occurred. What are the pieces that we're missing? I get the transparency. We're all for transparency. But I've also seen this body here work away from transparency in literally every facet of what we just passed last year in elections. So I find it interesting for the last 30 years that transparency wasn't an issue on local elections. But now that local elections are seeing greater participation across the state to challenge a one-party rule or focus on it, especially in school boards, that they don't like competition. And so this could easily be viewed as we don't like competition, and so we're gonna put pressure on those entities to remove it. And to me, that is what's driving this. With the challenges that we've seen, I think in the description of the transparency and entities and stuff, one description I didn't hear is union contributions to those particular races, are they included? And I guess for me, the one issue I think we had this year, which I'd like the Senator Baldwin, I'd like to know if you believe it will take care of this, is I believe Education Minnesota willfully withheld information from a reporting perspective on their role and participation in support of school candidates. And so will this type of reporting, do you believe, will it take care of that? Will it make them more accountable and more transparent from their perspective, this particular change in the rule? Because what you're trying to bring is people who you believe are not compliant into some compliance and transparency. Would it bring that particular type of entity into compliance and provide more transparency?
Senator Bolton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Curran, for the question. I guess I would maybe reframe the intent a little bit. I don't know that I'm saying that my intent is to bring people who are not in compliance into compliance. My intent is to bring some standardization and to ease some burden from local clerks and other workers who are doing this work to the Campaign Finance Board, who does this every day, all day. And so it's not necessarily changing the requirements. It's streamlining the reporting process and the resources available to folks and having information go into one place.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Grant, follow up.
Thank you, Senator Baldwin. And I believe those things, again, what you just described, are already being taken care of just fine at the local level, the party that used to be for local control. And again, I share your transparency, but it's much easier at the local level for our citizens to have accessibility to their local officials to get any answer they need than it is at the state level. And although Mr. Sigurdsson, you've served us and his organization has served us very well, when you look at the expansion of it, I don't think that serves the best needs of Minnesotans. And so it, to expand compliance and to bring all of those local entities into it, it seems a little bit odd that there wasn't something we're trying to solve. And so far, I haven't heard anything articulated that there was an identified challenge. Somebody's not meeting local filing requirements. And so transparency was not provided, and it influenced elections or impacted. One scenario that I saw this year was certainly Education Minnesota. And so if we're going to do something like that, we should make sure that all entities are brought into compliance, or the actions or the current laws and the policies are just fine at the local level. And so I'm more interested in how do we make sure that the heavy-handedness of one large union that doesn't like to make partisan politics political, who's led them forever, I'd like to see them brought into compliance if we're going to expand this burden onto everybody. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Grant. Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just would reiterate sort of the intention of this is to provide some standardization, some sameness across the state. This bill is not going to solve every problem, and there certainly are other bills to solve other problems. And I appreciate Senator Curran and Senator Anderson that you have not heard concerns about this. But there are concerns about this. This is, a difficulty for some localities who, have lots of other things to do within their role and within their work. And taking this piece of the responsibility away from them to an entity that this is what they do all day, every day, is desired.
Mr. Chair,
good follow. Stop. I have a question from Senator Westland.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bolden. So just to make sure I'm clear, this bill that you're bringing forward is not a candidate reporting requirement. It's a PAC, political committee, political party recording requirement. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Westland.
Bolden. Yes, that's correct.
So all of these groups already have
Senator
to make...
Westland.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. I forgot I'm not in court. Where were you on the night of the 24th? So these groups already have to make reports to the Campaign Finance Board. My understanding of what you are trying to do with this is that we are seeing more and more organizational money flowing into local campaigns. And what I understand you to be saying is this will warehouse all of that information in one place that's centrally located. People already go there to look for state and local state and other officials to see who's contributing to what. And my understanding from what you're trying to do here is this actually brings more transparency about the money flowing into local elections. Is that the intention of this bill?
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Westland. Yes, that would be the outcome of this bill is exactly what you described. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Senator Graham.
Senator Westland, my question was, Senator Westland answered or asked my questions about the candidate side, so thank you.
Okay. I have a question that if this is will the information be separate from other campaign finance data? So when you go in and look at contributors, for instance, does it show the contributors that are local and the contributors that might be for other races that are within the state?
Mr. Chair,
Sigurdson.
Under the provisions of this bill, committees that were formed around local ballot issues, for example, would be treated as a political committee or a political fund or party in theory, just like any other political committee. So all their information then would be posted on our website and would be available. To clarify a little, there is a difference here. The political committees registered with the board can spend money on local elections, and that's disclosed in their report. Committees that are formed only for local ballot questions, whether it be county, city, or school board, never file with the board. So there's information coming down if a committee wanted to spend on a particular county election that's registered with us, you'll see that on their report. But if there's a committee that's registered in the county, or that it's not registered because 211A actually doesn't require anyone to register, but if they're reporting through 211A to the county, that information doesn't come up to us. That's the, just to clarify which way the information is flowing.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Bolden, are you ready to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bolden moves Senate File 3499. We recommend. We're laying that one over, so it will be laid over. Thank you very much, Senator Bolden. And now we have Senate File 3501, which is also Senator Bolden. And we still have our testifier online. And so, Senator Bolden, can you describe 3501?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is also a fairly straightforward bill, which looks to establish a work group to examine whether we should have local candidates file campaign finance reports with the Campaign Finance Board instead of the local auditor or clerk. So just as the previous bill, we were talking about PACs and other entities and not candidates. For this bill, we are talking about candidates, local candidates, and developing a work group to work through the question of should they report instead of to their local entities up through the Campaign Finance Board. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a testifier that you would like to have give her perspective on it? Ms. McLaughlin, please identify yourself again for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Karen McLaughlin. I am a member of the Rochester School Board. And again, thank you, Senator Bolden, for my opportunity to testify here. I am testifying in support of Senate File 3501. Again, our democracy is stronger when the voices and interests of voters are at the center. Part of that core value means publicly disclosing what candidates are spending on our local elections, providing consistent information about filing campaign finance reports, and most importantly, voter access to spending information. Rethinking local candidate reporting would also help strengthen our democracy by creating a system that provides consistency, oversight, better enforcement, and clarity to candidates and voters. Currently, local candidates reporting looks and functions differently depending on where in Minnesota you live. This creates inequities for public access to information as well as for candidates as they try to follow complex campaign laws. As a candidate for school district, campaign finance reports currently are filed directly with the district's Office of Administration. In my experience, candidates rely on informal advice from more experienced local candidates, district website information, state statute, and information provided to new candidates interpreting these statutes to know where and what to report. Other local candidates file their reports with the city clerk's office, county auditor, and township clerk, depending on the office. In my experience, local candidates want to do what's right and follow the rules, but the current system does not instill confidence in candidate and treasurer compliance. One place to file reports for all state and local candidates, one consistent source of information, and one place for voters to look for campaign finance information would strengthen our democracy. Campaign finance laws are complex, and there are thousands of local candidates every year in Minnesota who struggle to follow these laws. Depending on where a candidate lives, their local auditor or clerk may have significant capacity to provide technical support to ensure the laws are formally and properly followed. But for many candidates, especially in rural areas where the clerk or auditor might be a part-time position or might have significant additional responsibilities, the level of support provided can be minimal. Consistent public access to information is vital for fair elections across the state. Finally, the bill would also establish a working group that would bring all the relevant stakeholders to the table to create a local candidate reporting process that provides uniformity across the state and equal levels of candidate support, regardless of geography, campaign experience, or connections to receive informal advice and direction from other local candidates. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of the testifier?
I see none.
Oh. I hear someone ask something.
Oh, Senator Grant.
For the testifier. So, okay. Senator Bolden, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bolden, now we know the question, same question, right? It's on to offload this, the work that the local entities have signed up for. What's the fiscal note on this one? Is there a fiscal note requested?
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Curran. I just received the fiscal note right before committee, and it came to $34,000.
$34,000.
Senator Bolden and Senator Curran, we have Andrew, the fiscal analyst, who can speak to the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, Senator Curran, members, the fiscal note is listed as $34,000, which does not include $47,000 in absorbable costs for some of the members of the working group per diem. The $34,000 would be for other expenses that are not absorbable at the LCC for some of the staff that's already taking care of the administrative stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank
Senator
you.
Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. So, Mr. Sigurdsson, when we look at the number of entities, how many candidates do you manage today, campaign finance reports, with between state and, or not between state and federal, you only have the state role. And so it's that total 600, 700 in a year, or an election cycle, a presidential election cycle?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Curran, that's a good estimate. Around 700 during an election year, it drops down to about 600 during a non-election year.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Grant.
So, Mr. Sigurdsson, what's the, it seems that's $34,000 not even a full additional FTE for your organization to manage all of the local offices. My Senate district alone has some 160 elected officials. That just elected positions, not candidates. So what's the estimate in the additional volume of candidates? In the thousands, I assume. What is that forecast?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Curran, I believe the fiscal note is only for costs associated with the task, with the working group. It's not for the actual administration. I believe the working group would determine whether or not the board's even the proper instrument for collecting the information. It's just for the staffing cost, I believe, and other associated costs.
In other words, Mr. Sigurdsson, that it's a working group to determine what the next step is.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Other questions? Seeing none, Senator Bolden, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Bolden moves Senate File 3501 be recommended to be forwarded to the State Government Committee. In favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is passed. Senator Bolden, you are on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Now, just to make sure that everybody knows how this is going, we have a tour that I'm hoping that the people that have signed up to will come tomorrow to go to Scott County. I think there's a lot to be learned there. Beth Fraser, our committee administrator, has done a lot of work in arranging that. So we want to get there and we want to learn as much as possible. So, Senator Anderson, you look like you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a conflict tomorrow, so I'm going to send my legislative assistant on behalf and take notes. So if she shows up, which I'm praying she does.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. We're going to take a roll.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you never know with this weather, you know, we might just have another snowstorm.
Yeah. No, we won't have another.
Mr. Chair, I challenge Senator Anderson. This is just a basic mild Minnesota winter. What are we worried about? But I scheduled that we have a legislative audit commission, which I'll be attending. And so I will also be sending my staff. Melissa Field will be in attendance. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
You know, we've canceled things for less than what weather storms have happened.
We won't cancel this. This will go on regardless.
Yes.
Okay, with that, our business for today is done. Thank you very much. And the meeting is adjourned.